Hello, I'm Christopher Cassan, and this is Ireland's Edge. From the horrendous destruction of Gaza to the ongoing Russian invasion of Ukraine to the return of Donald Trump, geopolitics feels terrifyingly unstable right now. On this week's episode, we hear from one of the world's leading foreign policy analysts, Dr. Fiona Hill, about the state of global politics and the murky world of international affairs. Originally from the north of England and now Chancellor of Durham University, Dr. Hill found herself at the centre of the impeachment trial of President Trump after her time as Senior Director of European and Russian Affairs on the US National Security Council. She had previously worked at the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard, the Brookings Institution, and as an analyst for Presidents George W. Bush and Barack Obama. In front of a live audience at Ireland's Edge in Dingle last December, she spoke on a huge range of political and personal issues with RTE Europe editor Tony Connolly. This is View from a Hill.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's a huge pleasure for me to introduce Fiona Hill and to interview Fiona Hill. She is a major stellar figure in the worlds of diplomacy, academia, policy making, specializing in democracy, Russia, Ukraine, energy, conflict, divisive politics, and so on. A quiet period for you, I guess, then.
Pretty much so, yes, exactly.
Where do you think we stand at the moment? We've been chatting outside. It's not a very happy time for the world, and I was thinking about the other periods in history of great anxiety. People think of the Cuban Missile Crisis, but at least there, Europeans could think that, or be reassured that the West, in the personage of the United States, John F. Kennedy, were in charge and could be trusted. But that those days have gone, I guess.
Yeah. Where to start, really, with this?
Exactly. I mean,
I think particularly that was obviously a pretty loaded question there.
Thank you.
Because you do start to, think that on the one hand, you know, we've had this fixation on the United States and its role for 100 years now. And if we start to think of it in that perspective, you know, thinking about, I don't think any of us were here when the American cavalry literally, you know, came through the Arc de Triomphe in Paris, you know, for the liberation of Paris after World War I, 1918. But we'll have obviously seen many of the pictures of that. To actually think that everything depends on the United States for that whole sweep of time for 100 years is actually, if you think about it, a bit preposterous. Mm. That after all that time, European security has been so entwined with that and means that everything that happens in Europe, as well as then, you know, more broadly internationally, rises and falls with domestic politics in the United States. I was thinking in terms of, just obviously World War II and the importance of, you know, the United States taking a role there. If we look back, in fact, though, to 1939, to Pearl Harbor, there was a huge debate in the United States about whether they should come in again. I mean, I think, you know, more people will probably remember those debates, thinking about Winston Churchill was trying to call in every chit he had, from his family ties to all of his kind of friendships and networks. About 90% of Americans in polls were not very keen on continuing to support the United Kingdom. You know, remember, I mean, France at that point had totally and utterly capitulated to Nazi Germany. Germany was occupying most of Europe. It's not a dissimilar, you know, situation from, you know, what we're seeing playing out in Ukraine, but it took Pearl Harbor, you know, to bring the United States fully into the war and to change the conception.
There was an America First sentiment
there absolutely
in the
was.
States at that
absolutely
time.
Was. And there has been at many different, you know, points as well. So it's not a new thing that we're kind of wondering if the United States is going to be there. And, you know, obviously in the 1980s, the height of the Cold War, you know, Reagan was very much there. There was the Euro missile crisis that actually you and I, and actually many people in this audience, will remember, worrying that the United Kingdom and the rest of Europe, Ireland, you know, potentially too, despite neutrality, would be ground zero for a nuclear exchange between the Soviet Union and the United States, and nobody really trusted Reagan then anyway. You know, we thought JFK, a safer pair of hands, but everybody thought that Reagan wasn't a very safe pair of hands, and neither was Margaret Thatcher, and everybody was really worried. That's how I started studying Russian, you know, worrying, you know, kind of about the consequence of this. And now we've got this horrific set of circumstances in the Middle East, which in many respects is akin to Pearl Harbor in terms of opening up with a surprise, shock, horrific attack a whole new wave of conflict. Not one that didn't exist before, of course, but has now, you know, completely changed the landscape from just having a major land war in Europe. All eyes are on the United States to settle this yet again. But unlike in terms of Pearl Harbor, where the United States was all in on another arena, and in fact, we've also got to remember there's Taiwan, there's China, there's tensions in the Asia Pacific. We'd all been thinking before the invasion of Ukraine by Russia that maybe the next thing we'd all be contending with as a world was a war in Taiwan or over Taiwan, with the United States and maybe Japan and South Korea and other, you know, countries implicated in a conflict in the Asia Pacific and the South China Seas and around Taiwan.
Good times, in other words.
Yeah, so we've got a really complicated geopolitical situation here, and in many cases, you know, I just heard on, you know, the news this morning or in some of the conversations, only the United States can resolve this. Well, why can only the United States resolve it? We could, you know, unpack why that seems to be the case, and actually, I would argue, can't be the case, because, you know, the United States cannot shoulder all the burdens, and its domestic political situation, as you're talking about here, puts on so many constraints that the United States can't always be the honest broker. We've seen, you know, that playing out in many scenarios, but also doesn't have the resilience. Think about that for a moment, the resilience and the internal strength to be able to resolve this.
Yeah. We'll get into a lot of these big global political issues a bit later. I didn't do a formal introduction because I think people know Fiona's background, senior fellow at the moment on the United States and Europe at the Brookings Institution. She was a national advisor for President Trump on the National Security Council, a policy advisor on Europe and Russia and Eurasia and so on. She was an intelligence officer for Russia and Eurasia at the National Intelligence Council between 2006 and 2009, really steeped in the higher levels of American foreign policy and diplomacy. You grew up in Bishop Auckland in the northeast of England. Did you have stirrings of this future career when you were a child? What were your memories of the northeast of England in the 1970s? Who was your team? What music were you listening to? The important stuff.
Well, I hate to say it, but we were a bit all over the place on who the team was. My dad was a coal miner, and he played in the kind of local welfare leagues, you know, the amateur leagues. And he played with people who went on to, you know, play in all kinds of, you know, different teams. So sometimes he'd support Newcastle, sometimes it was Sunderland, sometimes it was Middlesbrough, and sometimes it would be even further afield, depending on who he'd played football with, who'd gone on, you know, to play someone else. My dad was a bit of a loyalist to his friends and the, you know, the people he admired. I remember going to see Bobby Charlton. Wow. When I was a kid, playing for Preston North End, yeah. And I was going to Dad West Preston. You know, I wasn't really sure even at the time. You know, when I was a kid there. I mean, in terms of music, I mean, honestly, I was a big Pogues fan. But it was along with, and so I have to say, people were asking me the other day about how did I feel about Henry Kissinger dying, and then about 10 minutes later, we learned that Sean McGowan had died, and nobody was asking me about that. I felt like I'd have more to say. It was all, you know, it was
compare
that era of
19...
Compare and contrast.
Like, yeah,
Shane McGowan exactly, yeah, and Henry Kissinger. That would have been an interesting one, wouldn't it, actually?
Yeah,
maybe
exactly,
maybe for
yeah,
the next the next
well,
festival.
Both gravelly voices, for
very
a start.
Gravelly voices, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah,
both. And both lived longer than we expected, to be honest.
Absolutely. I mean, you've talked before about your roots. Your father was a coal miner. He was then a hospital porter. He met your mother. She was a midwife. I mean, were you aware politically at that age? You know, given that you were at the sharp end of some of the social problems that Britain would have had in the 70s and 80s.
Yeah, look, I was totally aware of what was going on. I mean, I was listening to the last panel on the media, and, you know, I thought about, you know, local newspapers a lot. So my local paper in the north of England was the Northern Echo, which is actually one of the longest running local newspapers. And just, you know, what our colleagues were talking about was spot on. You know, they drew you into the national and international news by telling you things about the local. You know, I wasn't necessarily reading the court pages to find out when one of my neighbours had been, I mean, there's a lot of court cases, you know, you can imagine, in deprived areas, you know, kind of who'd been, you know, kind of arrested for doing this, that or the other. But I was very interested in how the local affairs fed into national and then international. You kind of got immediately aware that you were a sort of a data point and that you were living in history at the same, all at the same time. My granddad, my dad's dad, had fought all the way through World War I. Everybody in my family had some kind of story about how international affairs had affected them
Even was though it, was it a Labour family, would you say?
Yes, but yeah. My mum, her grandfather was the first working class Liberal council representative. But he'd been put up for this by the man he worked for, Lord Furness, who was the big ship owner. So that was complicated.
Right.
He was obviously a front for the for the landed gentry. We didn't talk about that one too much. My dad would eye roll, so, you know, yeah. kind of that he, you know, because he hadn't had the shilling, but he was put up as the the Liberal candidate. But everyone was always talking about politics. My next door neighbour was Welsh. He knew Neil Kinnock. He was an activist and very active in the Labour Party, and he would talk a lot about, you know, social issues. And, you know, everybody watched the news on the BBC.
And that prompted your interest in Russian as well, is that right?
It did, because it was the Ural missile war scare in the 1980s when I decided to study Russian. 1977 to 1987, but again, looking out, not being rude, but I see a few other grey hairs around here. You probably remember, you know, again, like I mentioned before, the Euro missile war scare. Yep. And by 1983, that has really, you know, reached a crescendo. You have Threads, The Day After, all these movies and TV series.
There was a real sense that it was imminent, right?
And actually, when I got into the government later in the National Intelligence Council, I got to look at the files. Because we're in the process of being declassified about predecessors in that time period, and we were really close, I mean, to literally having a nuclear exchange, because there was Operation Able Archer that the Americans had in 1983, in which it was a full-scale military operation, and they also practiced in full view of, you know, basically nuclear simulations. And the Soviet Union at that point, they didn't really know how to gauge this. It's just like, you know, everybody says, how is it that, you know, people couldn't have seen that the Russians were about to invade Ukraine? Or how is it that this is in the papers now that, you know, basically the Israelis didn't recognize what Hamas was going to do? Well, we had many of the opposite versions of this during the Cold War, where the Soviet Union started to think the US was going to do something, or the US thought that the Soviet Union was going to do something because of exercises. And
it was game theory.
And it was theory, right? The whole game theory. And so the Soviet Union was looking for any sign that was going to be a first strike.
Yeah.
And it came to the attention of Ronald Reagan, in fact, that the Soviets were completely terrified by this. And he suddenly realized, oh, my God, you know, we were really that close. And
there was did they even... know you were going through these files in the National Intelligence?
Yes, they did.
Okay.
Because we were looking through some of the private files of my predecessors because they were actually going to be declassified. So there's actually a whole book about this now with all these declassified documents, and people can actually go, instead of me wittering on about it, and go online and see a lot of these stories. There was also the episode where a young, you know, Russian military officer averted nuclear Armageddon recognizing that was a false alarm instead of pushing, you know, the button in response. Yeah. And this is all in that same time frame.
I mean, he guessed that there couldn't be an attack, so it must be a false alarm.
That's right. Did you go and interview him, by the way, when you were a journalist? Because a lot of people went out to talk to him in the
I didn't get that chance. Unfortunately, no. I wish I had.
Thank God, this you know, previously unknown young Soviet military officer saved all of us from literally from nuclear
annihilation.
Yeah. So that's the backdrop of deciding to study Russian, because I was frightened, you know, that there might be a nuclear war. And one of my great uncles said, well, Pet, you know, stop, like, frightening, you know, about all this. Why don't you go and learn Russian?
Yeah. And did you go to... So you went to Moscow after studying in St. Andrews. You went to Moscow for a year, is that right? You were working with NBC, I think.
I did, in 1987, yes. Yeah. So I went on an exchange from the British Council. There was lots of... students from a number of other universities there. It was one of the first exchanges where the Soviet Union was really opening up, because this is Mikhail Gorbachev. It's the peak of perestroika, and I would say it was probably one of the most hopeful, optimistic times, you know, that one has ever experienced in the whole history of these relationships, which means to say that it might come back again. It's a bit hard to recognise that, but when we start thinking about how things could change in the future, nobody expected Gorbachev to come along, open up the Soviet Union, the end of the Cold War. I was there when Gorbachev and Reagan signed the INF Treaty, ending the whole Euro missile crisis. So, you know, suddenly we were on a different trajectory. It had been a black, bleak period, getting back to where we started. And then it suddenly became much more optimistic. And during the course of the Gorbachev-Reagan summit, all of the American cable companies were absolutely desperate to get people who ostensibly spoke English. Mm. And they put up in basically a poster in the embassies, and I saw that, and I came along to basically see if I could get one of the jobs of a stringer.
People who spoke Russian?
That's right. Yeah, they wanted English speakers, Russian speakers, because they wanted people to talk to the American camera crews.
Right.
And when they interviewed me, he said, "Are you sure you speak English?" Because, you know, I had a very they couldn't understand a word I said.
Yeah.
So they put me on some pretty bizarre jobs. I had to spray the hair of the anchor, Tom Brocco, on the top of the the top of the Russia Hotel. I'd have to stand there and go, "Mr. Brocco,
could you just shattered my illusions about my hero."
I know, yeah. Exactly. And I had to make coffee for Maria Shriver, and I was very excited because I realised she was married to Arnold Schwarzenegger, and we all knew Arnold Schwarzenegger. So I thought, "Wow, that Maria Shriver." But that's how I found out that there were scholarships to the United States. And so, you know, as they say, the rest is history, because an American professor who was an advisor to the NBC News told me there was all these scholarships to go to the United States. Mm.
And then you went from there, so you were studying in Harvard, the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard, Strengthening Democracy, Conflict, Eurasia, and so on. So you were staying in that particular lane. I just want to jump forward a little bit to 2004, and you talked about that, you know, the transitional periods in Russia. The 90s were, you know, fairly helter-skelter periods. You had the financial crisis, you had the Yeltsin era, the rise of the oligarchs, the chaos, the humiliation, I guess. And then Vladimir Putin comes along, and there is a moment of, well, okay, this is a transition, but he's promised to impose some order on Russia. And then at the same time, there was this huge surge in revenue from oil and gas, and that's something you've been specializing in. I just want to read out something you wrote in 2004. You probably won't thank me for this, but it was Energy Empire, this article. It might have been for the Brookings Institute. You talked about the growth of the Russian economy. There were still vestiges of Soviet hard power, but generally the money was going to butter rather than arms. And you said, at this juncture, in spite of the war in Chechnya, repeated confrontation with Georgia in the South Caucasus, and a recent show of force in a dispute over the Kerch Strait in the Black Sea, no regional state reasonably anticipates a Russian military invasion.
At this juncture. Yeah.
Very important qualification.
I know, exactly.
Exactly.
You see, that's the problem we're all dealing with, isn't it, right? At this juncture, because things change. And, you know, I think, you know, what we always have to be alert to is those factors and those signs of change.
Yeah.
And actually one comes along fairly quickly. In fact, after that, famous last words. I mean, remember poor Secretary Blinken and the National Security Advisor, Jake Sullivan, was saying the week before the Hamas attacks, all seemed quiet on the Eastern Front in the Middle East.
Exactly.
At this juncture. Because, I mean, again, you know, this is also like 9/11.
Yeah.
You know, at this juncture, you know, then things, you know, I mean, things happen.
Yeah.
You know, events, dear boy. In 2004, it's, as you say, it becomes the Orange Revolution in Ukraine. The Ukrainians push back against Russia's efforts to impose upon them Viktor Yanukovych, who later does become president of Ukraine. And after that period, you start the tensions between Ukraine and Russia start to mount. And by 2006, that's when I would certainly have been going back and revising
Exactly. Well, you mentioned
because they turned the gas off for the Ukrainians from the transit.
So these are patterns
gas
that have been there for quite some time.
And remember, I mentioned the Kerch Strait, with the exception of the Kerch Strait.
Yeah.
I've been going back over, looking at what the Russians were doing in the Kerch Strait now, time and time again, looking for those early signs, because you can miss them at a certain point. And everybody who's an analyst has to have humility about this. You've got to be able to go back and look, well, what did I miss? What did I miss then? And are you, you know, feeding yourself? And I'm sure, you know, you do that all the time in journalism. You're just feeding into a pattern. You're just hearing what you want to hear. You know, what is it that you're missing?
Mm. Yeah, well, it's a very good point. I mean, you mentioned 9/11. I think there was a feeling Vladimir Putin was the first foreign leader to call George W. Bush after the 9/11 attacks, and they acquiesced in the stationing of U.S. bases in Central Asia for the invasion of Afghanistan. You know, that combined with this sense that there might be a more forward-looking, modernizing Russia on the horizon, and then things turned turtle. Putin made his famous speech at the Munich Security Conference. I mean, I guess we're still analysing what happened, but why did Russia take that course and not another course?
Well, again, I think there are multiple factors here. One of them is actually related to the economy and economics. because, you know, you mentioned, as you were sort of framing out the questions here, that Putin was actually really lucky. Oil and gas prices just rise exponentially in the period when he comes in to be president, which is why we did have some hope that he might be pragmatic. And I wrote this, you know, monograph that you were referring to there about, you know, Russia's energy empire. Mm. That, you know, Russia was going to try to exert itself through commodities and through business. And in fact, you had a senior official, one of the very people who'd brought Putin to Moscow from St. Petersburg in the first instance, Anatoly Chubais, who I'm sure you know well, who was one of Yeltsin's reformers, saying that in the past we had the Red Army, now we have Gazprom and Lukoil. So in other words, Russia was going to look to more exert influence through oil, gas, business and commercial issues. This is the time when the Germans get lured in, you know, to start thinking about
Nord Stream
and also thinking about expanding their relationships. And Russia's goal under Putin at that point is to become genuinely one of the G7, G8 countries. Gorbachev had been brought in as a way to try to help the Soviet Union into the G8, to one of the meetings. Post-Soviet Russia under Yeltsin was a basket case, you know, wasn't at all one of the leading economies. And Putin does have these aspirations to make Russia one of the leading economies. And then he starts to be more assertive in the foreign policy. We've seen that pattern with China, of course, and, you know, we see it with other countries. Because by 2005, 2006... Putin is able, because of this huge windfall from oil and gas revenues, to pay off all of Russia's debt. And one of the constraints on Russia before was it was completely loaded with debt. Public debt, private debt, you know, you name it. And they pay it off. And then you start to see a more assertive Putin because he's kind of unshackled. And they start to build the military back up again. Mm-hmm. And by the time you get to 2007, that famous speech you cite at the Munich Security Conference, he's sort of saying, you know, we're back, or we're starting to be back. No more Mr. Nice Guy. We're not playing second fiddle or, you know, basic subservient state anymore to the unipolar American hegemon, and it all gets couched in America.
But people talk about a number of other factors, such as the Orange Revolution in Ukraine, the idea that popular opposition to a dictatorship could take to the streets and unseat somebody, as we'd seen in 2004, very successfully, or at least, you know, reverse an election that had been rigged. And then, of course, you had the question of NATO expansion, the big bang of new members to the EU in 2004.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there is an ongoing debate that I don't think people have really resolved about whether NATO expansion did contribute to a sense of paranoia that is part of the Russian DNA, I think, if you like, going back centuries to the Tsarist times. I mean, do you give any credence to the argument that NATO expansion had anything to do with Putin's much more robust and antagonistic mindset that gave rise to the invasion?
It's an additional factor. You cited the report that I wrote in 2004, but I wrote a much earlier report in 1994 called Back in the USSR, just riffing off the Beatles. But the whole point there was, so this is early 1994, 10 years before this piece, actually warning that already under Yeltsin, there were signs that Russia was trying to go back and regain control over the former Soviet republics. Mm. And in October of 1993, a lot of people will have forgotten about this, Yeltsin got into a fight with the Russian parliament, the Duma, and ended up shelling the parliament over the Russian constitution, the new Russian constitution, whether it should be more emphasis on the president or more emphasis on the parliament. I mean, you know, kind of, there's a lot of Irish and other UK history of parliamentary and sovereign or other, you know, executive power strife. But this was, you know, a classic case, and it already showed that there was a shift in the thinking. Yeltsin wanted to be a stronger president. There were a lot of hardline people around Yeltsin who also didn't like the way that the rest of the Soviet Union, because remember, this is only 2 or 3 years after the collapse of the Soviet Union, the Ukraine and others were getting away. There's no talk whatsoever in 1993 about expansion of NATO, but there is at that point lots of pressure being put on by the United States, the UK and other countries for Ukraine, Belarus and Kazakhstan to give up nuclear weapons that they'd acquired as a result of the collapse of the Soviet Union. And you already get all these questions about whether Ukraine can be trusted with nuclear weapons, whether Ukraine is really a country.
There was the speech George W. Bush, H.W. Bush gave to the Ukrainian Parliament,
the,
which...
The so-called Kiev speech, where everybody was wondering whether, you know, Ukraine had the wherewithal or the other countries to be. And that pressure starts then. And you already see people around Yeltsin, not Yeltsin himself, manipulating this idea of Ukrainians are not Ukrainians, they speak Russian, there's 25 million Russians stranded in the near abroad, we have to bring all of this back.
So this is part of the Russian
mindset.
Yeah, it's
the mentality, because if you put NATO on top of that, of course that's kind of just accelerating trends that they don't want to see. And then getting back to what I said about the economy, suddenly Putin doesn't have the constraints that Yeltsin had. Yeltsin was bankrupt. And, you know, we might say, well, Yeltsin had made this big decision, but he didn't have any money. The Russian military was, basically a shadow of what the Soviet military had been. The Russians had been defeated in a domestic conflict in the 1990s in Chechnya. The army was in shambles. Mm-hmm. By 2007, Putin's got the wherewithal financially to do things, and he's building the military back up again. I think that's kind of what, you know, represents the switch. It's all of these factors. Yep. And he's already had that mindset. He comes out of that hardline group who want to put Russia back where it should be. And that eventually comes to involve taking some back of the kind of the lands that got away.
Were you watching all these events you were a national intelligence analyst in the both the Bush administration and the Obama administration. Were you seeing these red lights kind of blinking and trying to say, hey, guys, we need to watch this? Were you a voice in the wilderness, do you think? Or was this generally accepted as something that had to be minded, but, you know, eventually this German idea of engagement through trade, through oil, through Nord Stream, that things would be fine?
There's always this debate all the time. And, you know, a lot of us were warning that there was a problem here. And even if you were going to expand NATO or do all these other things, it didn't mean that you should just think that was going to solve everything. So 2008, when there was a request first by Ukraine and Georgia to have them considered at the Bucharest summit in April of 2008, you probably remember this one as well, for a membership action plan for NATO, we recommended against putting that on the agenda. And so did now head of the CIA, Bill Burns, who was ambassador in Moscow at the time. And part of it was because in Ukraine itself, more than 50% of the population were actually opposed to it. So this is very different, you know, from more recently. It was more of an elite project. The Georgians were really keen. And for some reason, the Georgians and Ukrainians thought that they would be stronger together in making this proposal. And in fact, it actually made it even more complicated. And most of the NATO European allies were opposed to it, with the exception of the Baltic states and the Poles and, you know, others who we might expect would, you know, kind of be very cognizant of all of the risks and the threats. And the point is that NATO isn't a panacea. You don't just get handed a piece of paper and say, right, you're in NATO now, and then you're suddenly massively protected. You have to actually, you know, walk the walk. You have to build up your military. You know, you can't just be, you know, there and kind of not be able to defend yourself. The Finns, who were not in NATO until, you know, very recently, they were neutral, but given their location with this huge 900 mile border with Russia, they were always ready to defend it. 280,000 reserve forces they could bring up, for example. Yeah. So we weren't really thinking through. A membership action plan isn't immediate membership. How are you going to ensure, you know, defense if you do something that will inevitably be seen as provocative, you know, by the Russians? And also, if you're going to go for something you can't achieve, you're going to look weak, and that's exactly what happened. There was a push because George Bush, President Bush, I mean, we did briefings to him. He said, yes, I know how this is going to be tough, but I've given my word that if they ask, I'll try to support them. There ends up being a compromise at Bucharest that, okay, you're not ready now to come into NATO, but you will be someday. And, of course, that just drives the Russians nuts. And we actually fully expected that Russia would not just invade Georgia as they did in August. I mean, it's just a few months later. Cause and effect is pretty obvious there. But that they would also do something in Crimea. Now, they didn't until 2014. Yeah. And the reason why is because the Ukrainians immediately pulled away from that. They got the message. And then they extended the lease on the Black Sea Fleet.
Right.
Now, what triggers off 2014 has got nothing to do with NATO by that point. The Ukrainians are being super cautious. It's because they want to join the European Union.
Yeah, the association agreement.
And this is the Maidan, revolution or, you know, kind of demonstrations in 2013. They're flying EU flags.
Yeah. So that was a huge moment in the narrative and the journey towards what happened in 2022. Meanwhile, for you personally, you were invited to join the Trump administration in 2017. I mean, given the nature of the election in 2016, given the importance of the alleged Russian influence, how did you feel about that invitation? Did you have reservations about working with Donald Trump?
Yeah, of course I did. But I didn't have any reservations about trying to do something about what the Russians were up to. So, I mean, I hadn't, like, you know, lost sight of what was happening. And look, I just want to put things in, you know, perspective. Vladimir Putin's been in power now for 23 years. At the very beginning, we didn't know a lot much about him. We know a lot about him now. People are always talking about this, that, and the other. Has he changed? Look, we've been watching him for 23 years doing nastier and nastier things, you know, as we go along. But he has outlasted, I don't know how many British prime ministers at this point, but, you know, certainly plenty of US presidents and Taoiseachs and, you know, national security advisors and people like me, you know, kind of coming in and out of government. We've never had any continuity. You know, people talk about the US deep state. There's no such thing. Because also, if you're in the Foreign Service in the United States, you tend to get moved around. Journalists like yourself, I mean, how many different postings have you had? You might have continued to work on, you know, Russia or Ukraine or follow things, but you're always getting assigned to do something else. Putin isn't getting reassigned. He's not getting voted out. He, you know, stepped back to be prime minister. He didn't really go anywhere. He was absolutely there the whole time, just had Vladimir, you know, instead of him, it was Dmitry Medvedev as his front person. Yep. But he was there all the time. He's never lost the plot, and he's always plotting. You know, so that's kind of the problem that we've had.
Yeah.
So I was really concerned that, you know, we were not going to be, you know, ready to deal with this. And I got approached by people I'd worked with previously in the National Intelligence Council, including General Flynn. So I wasn't hired by Mike Flynn, which I have to, you know, take people back to the period in which I worked with him was on Georgia in 2008. He was my counterpart in the chairman's office of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Mullen. And I had a great working relationship with him at that point. I couldn't quite figure out, to be honest, I kept thinking, is there another Michael Flynn? It's a common enough name. Maybe this is a different general. And I was like, no, it kind of looks like him.
There's only one Mike Flynn.
There's only one Mike Flynn. What the heck has happened? And then he was one of the people, there were numerous people, and people that he'd taken on his team who asked me if I would come in. And it actually was clearly signalling that they were worried about Putin and Russia. And, you know, I then consulted with everybody I could think of. Some people did honestly say to me, don't do this, because you'll be implicated in all these horrible things. This is a bad man. You know, and you'll be, you know, implicated in this.
Did you have any privileged knowledge from your vantage point as a national intelligence analyst about Russian involvement in the 2016 election and this whole question of kompromat that the Russians might have over Trump? I'll not get into the details, but, I mean, what were your own gut instincts about what had happened in 2016?
Well, my gut instincts were that the Russians had interfered, and actually I didn't need that. You know, we've also got the Mueller report will tell us that. I didn't actually believe the scandalous tape because that's a classic Russian ploy. And I knew I'd written a book on Putin with a colleague, and I'd written the book on Putin out of the government because I felt we didn't know enough in the government about Putin and that we needed to start asking. It gets back to this question about, you know, whether people see the intelligence they want to see or they begin to believe that the only thing that is real intelligence is some secret you've stolen. And somebody like Putin, he doesn't have an email account. You know, he's not going to let you hack into his email account. He hides everything about his family. You know, everything is just, you know, incredibly off limits. So we were trying to be more inventive about how could we figure things out about him. And as a result of spreading a you know, wide web, I'd come up with all kinds of other information that I was trying to, not from government sources, but from just trying to be creative and trying to figure out, you know, how this man ticked. So it was already obvious the things that they were trying to do. And any person, ourselves included, who's been to Russia or Ukraine or anywhere in the former Soviet Union has had some kind of approach. It doesn't mean that we've gone along with them, but I could tell you lots of stories, which I obviously won't, about all kinds of people, some of whom you know, who have got themselves into all kinds of difficulties because they've had a knock on the door. You know, there's always for men in the things like the honey trap idea. She doesn't really like you, not that good looking. You know, we women don't really have that kind of issue, but they try to get you at all kinds of, you know, a different ways. So, you know, did the Russians think when Trump visited at some point that he could be an asset? They think about that, about every single person. Every single person could be an asset. Every single business person. That's what Putin did for a living. When he joined the KGB in 1972, his job was to kind of run assets. But what he does do is he looks not just at compromising information, but what are people's vulnerabilities. And with Trump, you know, there might or may or may not have been the infamous whatever tape, but there was certainly the Access Hollywood tape. We've all heard that. And, I mean, there's 91 criminal indictments against him. He's gone through two impeachments. Everybody who had done business with Trump knew what kind of business person he was. We didn't need Vladimir Putin to tell us that. But Vladimir Putin recognised that Trump was uniquely vulnerable because he's a narcissist. Thrives on flattery, and he takes massive offence at anybody who insults him, myself included. So
you saw that close-up, did you?
Saw it all the time.
Describe what it was like to work for and with him.
Well, I mean, I'll just give you... there's no difference, by the way, between what you see in private and what you see in public, so I think you can all get the impression of what it would be like, you know, working with him. He paid no attention to people like me. One of the most bizarre things I had to do was buy an entire wardrobe of new dresses. I actually had my husband do this because I said, look, OK, look at this, just go out and just get a dress. It doesn't make me look like, you know, I've got it totally crazy here, but just help me out here, because I'm
honestly... Your husband went out to buy the dresses.
Yes, I made him
What was that experience
flash,
like
flash
for him,
sales.
Though?
Well, he did it on flash sales, right. You know, as a kind of... Because I just can't, you know, because I mean, it's just not my thing anyway. So I was told that every time I went into the Oval Office, I needed to wear a new dress, and you never knew what day you were going to go in, because he'll never remember you, but he'll remember a dress. And because I could never imprint, and he always thought I was, you know, middle-aged secretary, and never had any... I had to kind of reintroduce myself over and over and over again. It's like the goldfish, you know, kind of going round and losing their track. And he was never going to remember me, although later he seemed to have remembered my accent, but he was always going to remember the dress. I was literally told that. Get yourself a new dress. You had a bad moment the last time, just go in with a new dress. And I was like, how many bloody dresses am I going to have here?
What was your precise role at that point? What were you there to do?
Well, my role was... ostensibly to be an advisor. But really, I mean, in terms of dealing with Trump, you felt like you were the hazmat, you know, kind of operation. We used to kind of joke in the office, spillage in aisle six, send in the hazmat team, you know, trying to kind of figure out what we were going to do to deal with whatever, you know, crazy thing had happened. But outside of that, actually, things were quite normal from a government point of view. I worked with some amazing people, real, you know, patriots, real, you know, diplomats who were just totally mission-oriented. A lot of the people I worked with the National Security Council had gone through the US military, retired, and then wanted to serve. And a lot of people were assigned to the National Security Council from the military because they were the only ones who actually, I would just say, had the balls to, you know, and the fortitude, you know, to basically put up with a lot of this. And also weren't going to get swayed by, you know, not just the kind of chaos of it, but, you know, there was a real effort there to make people Trump loyalists rather than people who were working for the state. And that's what you're going to see if he comes back again. It's the cronyism and, you know, the people who have not got the country's interests at hand. Because what he saw it was, and I saw this again up close, was for Trump it was all about his personal family brand. So this was a merger and acquisition of the United States. And it was all about himself all the time. It's everything was self-referential, about something on his watch, something about this. And with Putin, when Putin was nice to him, that was it. I mean, he was eating out of Putin's hand because Putin was the iconic figure for him, the ultimate strongman.
I mean, at any point, could you feel that your advice was landing with him? Or did you just come out kind of clutching your head going, like, what's the point?
It was mostly that. But my advice, you know, was landing with my counterparts and with other members of the government, not all of them. You know, it was a plan B, C, and D were always kind of quickly put into operation. Plan A had been, and I think that was, I mean, I never got to Dr. General Flynn about it, and I probably will never, but the idea was that they would have me sit down and just do a straight talk on Putin. But Trump's view was like, how could somebody who's just written a book about Putin, some middle-aged woman, know anything about Putin? He wanted directly to talk to Putin.
Yeah.
Or he wanted to talk to people like Rex Tillerson, who the Secretary of State, who had done multi-billion dollar deals with Putin and ExxonMobil. But even with people like Rex Tillerson or General Mattis, he thought of them as secretaries, Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense. Not joking. That's exactly how
they didn't
Trump
have to wear dresses, though.
They did not have to wear dresses.
Not that we know of, but...
Yeah, but they were lucky.
Yeah. I mean, you've written very graphically about, I suppose, a high point or low point of this phenomenon you're talking about, which was the summit in Helsinki in 2018, I think.
Triggered. I'm already pulling my hair. And you were there.
I was there. I covered it.
He confessed he was there.
Yeah, I was in the press conference, which you were also in a few rows ahead of me. But you've written about how the kind of dread that you were feeling just got to a point where you wanted to throw an epileptic fit to stop proceedings. Just describe what happened.
And I also thought about, you know, kind of what's the finish for, you know, fire alarm, and I was kind of like looking around the room. And weirdly, there was a member of Congress did that quite recently during a heated debate. I thought, God, I hope he didn't hear me say that once on the table. He pulled the fire alarm and got censored. Because then I thought to myself, if I do something like that, first of all, it's completely inappropriate to fake some medical emergency. You know, that's kind of... But it was going through my head repeatedly. I thought I could fall back into the group behind. I hope you weren't there, Tony. I might have fallen back onto you.
I would have caught you, obviously.
Can I lunge, you know, over towards... Or does this just add to the spectacle? It was so humiliating. Yeah. And I could just see everyone in front of me just stiffening.
So the context here was that... It was his first big summit, I think, with Vladimir Putin. It was in Helsinki, and I suppose he wanted to channel his inner Reagan against Putin's inner Gorbachev, and it was the great man moment of history that two men would get together. And it was really about arms control, is that right?
It was, yeah. I mean, that's totally missed now from the press conference, because they'd and everybody also thought it was some sort of secret meeting. Trump doesn't speak Russian, everybody. You know, so, I mean, somebody has to translate. And the protocol is that you usually have your translator there. And our translators on the State Department, just, you know, like here in Ireland and, you know, anywhere else, they're top notch. Mm. You don't just have any old person just kind of, you know, going off the street to translate. Our translator had met Putin more times than anybody else. So this is a she. She completely, you know, got the whole picture of everything. She didn't need notes, you know, to kind of like come out, and because there was this incident where Trump took the notes of the other translator in Hamburg in a previous meeting, because he hated people taking notes. But in this case, it would have been a somewhat, you know, problem-free, not completely, because, you know, Putin's always trying to manipulate, and he did do something in there that was difficult. We were on it, and then the press conference came.
Yeah.
And basically, the big problem was not you, but, you know, some other journalist who, the instant they asked the question, I thought, oh, God. Or other worst words went around my head.
It was AP, I think, wasn't it?
It was AP, yeah. Because Trump had really thought that he'd moved the world away from danger. You know, the 1 minute to midnight idea. And he's actually been asked at one point, do you think the world is a safer place now that you've met with Putin? And he genuinely thought it was, because he'd had a great vibe. Mm-hmm. And he thought, you know, that... and he'd agreed that there would be some arms control discussions afterwards, and the National Security Councils would get together. And that was... It wasn't a huge achievement. It was a reasonable achievement, given the tensions in the relationship and all of the tensions around, was Trump really the Manchurian candidate or the Moscow candidate, had he been elected by Vladimir Putin? But Trump thought he was doing exactly what you thought. He thought he was about to have a whole new arms control era. He was basically a creature also of the 1980s. He probably saw threads in the day after, and he wanted to get rid of nuclear weapons, genuinely. And so, you know, we were supposed to be thinking about the START Treaty. You know, so think about the acronym START. And Trump really didn't actually say it, but he was practically saying he'd like the Super Trump Arms Regulation Treaty. So that was his idea, and that's what he was trying to do. And Helsinki was one of those iconic places. We could have gone to Reykjavik or Vienna, but the Finns were quite eager to try to facilitate this, so that was where we were. And then the question from AP after, you know, have you helped, you know, save the world from nuclear weapons, which is what he thought, and he was expecting another, you know, kind of flattering question. But of course, it was his nightmare question. It was, you know, will you say here in front of Vladimir Putin that the Russians interfered in the election? And Trump's biggest fear was that he actually hadn't really won the election.
Did you see his face just darkening?
Just darkened, deepened. And you could see Putin, you know, kind of putting poker face on, just kind of to wait to see what was going to happen here. And that's when, you know, Trump just goes off. You know, it's basically then says he believes Putin more than he believes his own intelligence. Yeah. Because he doesn't want to believe that, in fact, the 70 to 80,000 votes in three counties in three states weren't the factor of the bizarre electoral college. But if Putin had actually said, well, actually, Donald, we did, you know, win the election for you, he would have probably imploded, exploded, you know, all at once.
Yeah. And you were walking out behind Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump as the press conference ended. What was the sense you got from Putin, how he felt this famous press conference had gone?
Well, Trump went off, you know, one way and Putin went the other, but Putin was talking to his press secretary and I was with our interpreter and we were right behind because the whole idea was that we'd then move on to something else. But everybody in, you know, our group, of course, looked like they were just going to go walk off a cliff if, you know, there wasn't one there outside. And Putin turns to Peskov and he says, "Takoy bardak." And bardak is a kind of a Russian word that translates to brothel. But it's essentially, I don't know if this gets bleeped out, it's like
equivalent to
saying,
just let rip.
What a shit show.
Yeah.
So basically that was kind of, you know, what Putin thought of it all. Yeah. And of course he loved the humiliation. You could see him smirking. But he also actually tried to help Trump out because he immediately knew that that would be it. They wouldn't have the meetings of the security councils. There wouldn't be the next arms control. He wouldn't get to sit down with the American president again because he wanted that too. He wanted to show the world that he's still the great statesman and doing things as well. And so he was just really annoyed. And of course, but he'd already been playing with things as well and creating and stirring the pot. So it just all, you know, because he was at that point suggesting, and he'd sort of suggested to Trump that, you know, we were trying to get some GRU, some Russian military intelligence operatives handed over for interfering in the election. He'd suggested that, you know, then maybe Russians could interview some people who had been involved in, you know, the Magnitsky Act. And Trump didn't know what he was talking about and had kind of got himself confused. And, of course, that was never going to happen.
Yeah.
But that on
he
top
wanted
of
Bill
the,
Browder handed
that's
over
right.
as well.
And on,
yeah.
top of the, on top of the press conference, everybody, of course, thought that Trump had actually, given what had happened here, promised to hand over. It even went so far as people thinking the former American ambassador, Mike McFaul, which, you know, nothing of that had been discussed, just Bill Browder had come up, but Trump didn't know who Bill Browder was.
Yeah.
You know, so this was the whole classic Putin. But it had gone too far. He loved the humiliation Putin did, but then he started to obviously have second thoughts that actually this had gone just a bit too far, because what Putin wants more than anything is to always sit down with an American president and be the big cheese on the international stage.
And then things moved on fairly quickly then to another even more bizarre episode in Trumpistan, which was the Ukraine issue and this idea of linking American military support for Ukraine with a bid to get the Ukrainians to smear Trump's opponent at that time, Joe Biden. I mean, Ukraine was the file you were focused on tremendously. And you knew the U.S. ambassador, Maria Yovanovitch, who got caught up in this extremely bizarre smear campaign from Washington while she was in Kyiv. And then this formed part of the impeachment hearings that you got involved in then against President Trump.
Yeah, that was a totally bizarre episode. And, I mean, it's the kind of thing that, honestly, you couldn't make this up. I mean, you keep wondering why this isn't a Hollywood movie, because it's all just so ridiculous. I would often, you know, say that my best preparation for working in the Trump administration was reading Alice in Wonderland and Alice in Through the Looking Glass as a kid. Because one day you were at the Mad Hatter's Tea Party, you know, the next day you were at the Red Queen's Garden Party, where it was off with their heads. That's what happened to Masha Yovanovitch. Yeah. And then you were constantly dealing with, you know, Tweedledum, Tweedledee, and you were in the middle of the Jabberwocky. It was just like, oh, my God, you know, I'm like, you know, where am I?
So she was being accused of being some kind of George Soros.
We were all George Soros moles.
Right.
Who were
within
doing
the state.
Something, you know.
Within the deep state and so on.
That's right. And we were all a deep state cabal.
And she had to resign as a result of these completely unfounded, bizarre smear campaigns that were being launched by who against her? Who was doing this?
Well, there's Rudy Giuliani, and then two Ukrainian American business people who I didn't even know who they were. But Trump was always talking about his American Ukrainian friends telling him this, that, and the other, and of course that all kind of came out as who they were, and they were also like kind of, you know, characters from some TV program. It was just a weird, weird situation. But it was also deadly serious, not just because of the impeachment of an American president and all the other things that unfold, you know, on in that kind of moment, on multiple fronts. First of all, it's the first evidence that Trump is trying to stay in power beyond... It's the first stage of the opening up of a coup attempt, which we see culminate in January 6th, making it very clear he's determined to do whatever it takes to stay in office, from smearing opponents to getting rid of US officials to, frankly, making common cause with a whole cast of crazy characters, including in foreign countries. And on the second front, I think there's a direct line from that to Russia's invasion of Ukraine, because Putin looks at this and thinks these people are not serious, that Ukraine doesn't matter at all, and that I can just do whatever I want here. And Zelensky, obviously, at that point in the phone call, didn't really help himself too much. And we remember the text of the phone call. He's obviously trying to play for time, because Zelensky, at that point, really wants to have...
He'd just been elected president, right?
And what he was wanting was not just the military aid, but to have his moment in the Oval Office, because this gets back to the cachet. It's the same thing that Putin actually wanted, the cachet of sitting down with the American president. And Zelensky knew that was really important for legitimation. You know, it gets back to where we started with America, you know, being the big, you know, presence on the stage since 1918. And 1918 was the last time that Ukraine had independence after the collapse of the Russian Empire. So now you're in this phase, and all of Ukraine's, it's a huge moment. And you've been there many times, you know that. I mean, Ukraine's fighting for its independence all over again. And not having the, even just the symbolic support of a US president is pretty devastating. And then, you know, basically, if you recall back to January of 2020, not just, you know, what was happening on January 6th, Putin takes a very long time before he acknowledges President Biden, because he's kind of hoping that the United States is just going to keep on unraveling and totally crazy. And when people say, oh, well, if Trump had been in, Putin wouldn't have invaded Ukraine, yeah, he would have expected Ukraine just to fall into his lap. So he wouldn't have had to invade. He would have just got it.
As a result of this skullduggery over the arms, the attempt to smear Joe Biden and Hunter Biden and Giuliani's efforts, you were called in to testify to Congress in the first impeachment trial. That was not a pleasant experience for you for many reasons. Is that right?
No, I mean, you can't really. This is much more pleasant.
Well, I would hope so.
No, that was not. And clothes became a weird part of it as well. So the kind of the whole weird thing, and look, it gets back to all the things we've heard over, you know, the last few days here, is that, you know, telling the truth seems to be remarkably difficult to do. And sometimes how people perceive you gets in the way of them hearing the truth. So I actually had to sit down, not just with a legal team, but also with a very skilled PR person, to figure out how people would listen to what I had to say rather than look at me and judge who I was, especially because I've got this accent, you know, and I'm a middle-aged, you know, woman from, you know, God knows what. And we'd already known that the whole goal was to discredit us, all the people who were going to testify, and to predict, make us not just Soros moles, but this whole idea of being deep state coup plotters, coming from some cliquish elite. And, you know, Trump is the man of the people. So he's the supporter of the average American. And every single person I worked with, by the way, was an average American. Trump is, you know, a billionaire who daddy gave him, you know, his money to start off with. And it was this about him supporting the steel workers and the coal miners. And I was already right. My dad was a coal miner. I've watched this man. He is not a man of the people. So we already had to make this. You have to make a statement about who you are, what your background is. And I had a few things that actually would assist me in this, because I come from County Durham, and there is a place in County Durham called Washington County Durham, where George Washington's family came from. So we immediately decided, okay, we'll mention George Washington. Not get too carried away. It's not like I'm related to George Washington. But, you know, it's like, be a bit careful. Cousin George, you know, back in the day, you know, kind of, exactly. But the coal miner, you know, family ties to America, because lots of circular migration in my family, like many people here in Ireland, backwards and forwards to just an American by choice. I mean, these were my words, but they said, look, you're going to have to try to diffuse these attempts to depict you as some, you know, plummy accented, you know, coup plotter who's trying to take down, you know, Trump. before you can even open your mouth to actually give testimony. And then this was the weird thing. They said, we're going to have to decide what you're going to wear. And I said, oh, God, not again. And they said, but none of these dresses, you know, for the Oval Office, which is like my, you know, camouflage, you know, kind of going in there so I could get out again. This is just being as innocuous as possible. And I thought, well, my clothes are innocuous, aren't they? I said, no. And then they said, you're going to be on the style pages of the Washington Post. At this point, I did the massive eye roll. They said, oh, no eye rolling, you know, when anybody asks you a really stupid question. And so I actually had to... on the phone, you know, on WhatsApp, and lay out all my entire wardrobe and have, you know, someone pick what I was going to wear. And I was indeed on the front pages of the style section of the Washington Post saying that my, you know, my outfit was, what was it, sort of suitably boring.
Yeah. This was so that it wouldn't detract from the evidence you were giving.
And I was, you know, told no eye rolling, you know, kind of, the other thing was, you know, kind of, it was going to be cold. I mean, all these things that you think, is this really necessary? So I was told it was going to be cold in the rooms where we were going to give testimony. I should make sure to put some, you know, warm underwear on.
It was cold, wasn't it?
Thick tights, it was cold. Yeah. And then press the balls of my feet into the floor so my teeth wouldn't chatter, because then they'd think I was, you know, nervous and trying to hide something. And then, you know, picking a spot over here, don't make too much eye contact with the members of Congress, you know, kind of thing to...
You're also nuts. Subject to... hate mail, phone calls.
I was more worried about all of this bit. I thought, I can't believe this. You're doing your job. Mm. You want to tell the truth about what happened, and you're having to focus on what you're wearing, you know, how you comport yourself. And then, as you said, you get all these death threats. And I'm not on social media, and I actually highly advise all of you to be not on social media, particularly any of the younger people there in the audience. Because, I mean,
it's
most horrific things written, about everybody, but about women in particular. Yeah. Phone calls, I was advised by one colleague who was a detailee from the FBI to seal up my letterbox and, you know, not have any of my family go out the front door. And it was just, you know, kind of nuts. So pipe bombs, because, of course, that had been, you know, happening to people. And it's not just in the United States that these kinds of things happen as well. I mean, why are there so, you know, few women, you know, running, you know, for politics? Because you just get absolutely excoriated. And I know that many of the journalists, you know, have spoken about that as well.
I mean, it's tempting to look back at that period as a kind of a fever dream of some kind of weird Western aberration that propelled this individual to power, and that we're never going back down that road again. But that's not really the way things
are. No, we haven't got off that road. Yeah. I mean, in a way, it was a precursor of where we all are now. The far right has taken off in so many different places.
In many countries, yeah. How do you explain it? I mean, we talked outside about the huge rupture in public trust thanks to the financial crisis, and that was acutely felt here in Ireland.
Yeah.
There was a sudden slump in trust in institutions, including the media and obviously government and in banks. And I mean, are we still just paying the bill for that?
I think we are. Look, we're also, from the United States perspective, you know, that trust really was ruptured. And this is why, you know, when we're thinking about what's happening right now in the Middle East, we have to go really back to the whole post period after 9/11 and, you know, the invasion of Iraq. Because the United States has, I think, been dealing with the legacy of that horrific decision. I mean, I personally wouldn't have gone into Afghanistan either, but that was at least explicable from what bin Laden, you know, was doing. But bin Laden has succeeded, just like Hamas has tried to succeed in the same way of triggering off a war where, you know, the opposite side does terrible things in response and loses all confidence and loses all moral authority. The United States has steadily lost moral authority, getting back to where we started from being the cavalry coming through, you know, the Arc de Triomphe and down the Champs-Élysées in 1918.
No longer the indispensable nation.
Exactly, to being, you know, the country that just marauds all over the place, you know, kind of in response to, you know, what happened in 9/11. Islamophobia, the rise of ISIS, you know, all the kinds of things, you know, kind of really happened there. And you just see this kind of decline. And then the financial crisis on you know, the economic side exacerbates that even further, because of course it's because of the housing bubble and, you know, profligate spending and people getting over their heads with their, you know, mortgages in the United States. It starts in the United States and reverberates around the world. Now, COVID didn't there, of course, but that doesn't help. Mm. We're paying off a lot of bills here. And we could go on, right? I mean, I'm sure we could all, I could ask, you know, come up with another idea, and, you know, the audience, we'd all have, you know, multiple ideas. Mm. And the problem is, of course, that we keep on seeing that because of the complexity of this, there's no easy solutions. And the people who are succeeding, the people say, I'm going to fix it, or I alone can fix it. Because most of the people who are trying to fix it, they can't explain in the, you know, the process any effort to intervene in the economy. Incredibly difficult. There's always somebody pushing back against it who doesn't want, you know, that to come out because they'll lose their interests. And we do have a dearth of leadership. I mean, it's been a long time since we can point to world leaders and say, wow, that's really somebody that I can admire. Yeah. So you get all of that. And then as a result, it's very easy for people who have a pretty negative intent to get there, you know, kind of on the stage. And so I don't think this is going to go away for any time soon.
I know everyone will be dying to hear your views about what's been happening in the Middle East. You've alluded to it from your vantage point, and given your vast experience as a diplomat and an analyst, and you know, a very keen and knowledgeable person on U.S. foreign policy, how do we get out of this situation in the Middle East?
Well, we don't get out of it by just looking at the United States and saying this is the only responsible country. Because the United States, you know, has got a lot riding on what's happening domestically. And again, with this, you know, potentially, you know, well, it already is a momentous presidential campaign going, you know, everything is going to be then done through the prism of US domestic politics. And, you know, Biden, I mean, I would hope, you know, just on for everybody thinking about the future of American democracy, we don't want Trump getting re-elected. And it's not a question about, you know, Republicans or conservatives versus liberals or anything like this. This man is a menace, you know, to the world writ large, not just to American politics. And just think about the capriciousness and the vengefulness and all of the things that we're going to, you know, see if he comes back. And so there's a real risk, you know, right now that anything that, you know, is happening, Ukraine, Middle East, anywhere else, will have an impact back in the United States. So it's not just about how do we get, you know, peace in the Middle East, but how do we make sure that we then don't get these pretty negative outcomes, you know, happening in the United States as well, which means that I think other countries have to step up here as well. And a country like Ireland, militarily neutral, yes, that's actually really works to Ireland's favour, taken a strong stance in support of Palestinians for years. And you've also got an incredible amount of cachet, a good brand internationally. I think part of it is always people or countries are worried about ruining their brand. But you've also got an incredible experience in peace processes. You've got the, you know, basically anniversary of the Good Friday Accord. You know what it's like to be partitioned. You know what it's like to be occupied. You know what it's like to have been part of an empire. You know, so that kind of, you know, a way of being able to describe the process. And this works for Ukraine as well, by the way, because I think that, you know, Ireland has actually been very helpful, you know, to Ukraine, which is, you know, continues to be in a very dangerous position. We have to help Ukraine as well. You also know what it's like to be, you know, kind of bullied from the outside. And this is exactly what Russia's trying to do right now, by the way. Russia's trying to join these two conflicts together because they are joined because Russia's become dependent on Iran as a, through the course of prosecuting the war in Ukraine. Iranian drones, Iranian political support. And Russia might have actually been able to mediate somewhat in the Middle East because Russia's relations with Israel were shockingly good until October 7th. Yeah. October 7th was Vladimir Putin's birthday. And I think he sees this as an enormous gift because it now makes it very difficult for the United States to do anything. All the blame's on the United States. And Russia is now walking away from its ability to be able to engage with Israel.
Because they have relations with Hamas.
They had great relations actually with Israel before this, as well as, you know, that relationship with the Palestinians, with Hamas, etc. So Russia could actually have been a positive force here and has chosen to be a negative force. And Putin has done, you know, what inevitably happens, move from criticizing this to inevitably coming out with anti-Semitic comments. Putin's never done that before. So this is actually very significant that they've made this flip. Yeah. So I think other countries have to figure out how to step in here.
Yeah.
India is a very interesting actor. The Indians traditionally don't have a major position in the Middle East. Islam in India comes from a totally different direction. It comes from Central Asia, the Mughal Empire. They don't have, you know, deep ties in the Middle East. They actually, there's not really any kind of significant history in India of anti-Semitism. The Indians, you know, could actually step forward. China, if it wanted to, could also step forward. Again, the Chinese might be very reluctant to do this. You know, China is very concerned about Middle East oil. China actually does not benefit from higher oil and gas prices. China actually did step up to try to, you know, obviously mediate to some degree, although a lot of the hard work had already been done before China appeared, in the Yemen, Saudi Arabia, Iran nexus. I'm saying that there are other countries at this particular juncture that could play a role here in helping to find a solution. Because ultimately the solution is going to be really, really difficult.
Yeah, I mean, there's a very powerful belief, I think, in this country and many other countries, that Israel can't do what it does. It can't prosecute the war the way it has been doing without the tacit, overt military and political support that it gets from the United States. Can you explain to people why that support has always been so steadfast?
Well, it goes back, obviously, to the origins of Israel after World War II and the recognition, you know, of Israel as a state in 1948, the United States, along with many other countries, you know, guaranteeing its existence. Obviously, there are a lot of shared populations as well, Israeli-Americans. But also, I mean, in the terms of, you know, the United States, there has been, certainly at the political level, a huge effort to push back against anti-Semitism. And look, I think everybody has to remember here that there are ancient Jewish populations in the world that have nothing to do with Israel and the Middle East, or at least haven't for thousands of years. There are Jewish populations spread across the whole world. They're not just Jews who went to Israel from Europe. So that's already, you know, kind of a something that this is a fallacy already that, you know, Europe, you know, basically, you know, created all of this. There were Jewish populations in Yemen, in Ethiopia. There were also in Central Asia, Bukhara and Hiva. There are in the
expelled in 1948.
Yeah, and they are, and also in the Caucasus. There was this Makhachkala in Dagestan, where a bunch of mobs, you know, basically raided the airport. That has the oldest Jewish community in the world, one of the oldest communities in the Caucasus Mountains, that dates back thousands of years to before the fall of the First Temple. So this is a complicated history. People need to learn the history. Before, there was the huge Arab Jewish populations who all got expelled as well. So this is complicated, and it's going to, and then what the United States has always, you know, tried to do, though then again the thread keeps getting dropped from, you know, government to government, is trying to kind of keep the eye on the preservation of Israel, but then also trying to take the lead on the peace process. You know, if we think back to Clinton, you know, we had at Camp David and, you know, the whole Rose Garden, you know, what looked like a step forward, and Arafat, you know, basically dropped it. Then we had the Norwegians with the Oslo Accords. You know, we've had so many, you know, peace efforts. I mean, the Norwegians could be, you know, engaged again. The challenge is really how you deal with all the different constituencies, and this is why it becomes complicated in the US context, because there are so many different competing constituencies given the size of America and the complexity of this issue, which is why I'm kind of suggesting that, you know, despite the steadfast support and, you know, the particularly, you know, President Biden has a memory of Israel as a beleaguered country from the 1970s, as one that was being attacked by its Arab neighbours. I mean, the first effort to resolve the conflict back in 1947 and to, you know, basically create two states then was rejected by the Arab states, and then there was obviously invasions and, you know, attacks, and, you know, the commitment is there to, you know, basically support. So we've got to find within all of these constraints and all this complexity a way forward, and my argument is just that we're not going to do it with the United States alone. Mm-hmm. Because it's just like with Ukraine or any other issue right now.
Do you believe in the opportunity theory, that this is an opportunity, the darkest hour, like a horrendously ghastly moment on both sides, that the moribund peace process, the two-state solution, can be somehow miraculously revived? And how can that happen given the horrendous suffering and, you know, the long legacy of bitterness that will give rise to?
Well, we've had to experience that here on these islands as well, right? Probably not at the same scale that we're talking about here now, but, you know, I've worked in many, you know, conflicts that looked like they were intractable. And it takes a long time, but it takes a lot of international effort. And again, you've got to look for multiple honest brokers. And there has to be, you know, commitments to, you know, build up Gaza. There has to be a commitment to help Palestinians find a workable authority. I mean, what we've got to work with is not very much. So there's going to have to be commitment of all the surrounding states. You know, so who is in the best position, you know, to do that? And, You know, when you think about, you know, what happened here on a much smaller scale, it took a lot of effort. I mean, it also took 90 years, really, for full reconciliation, right, until Queen Elizabeth II came.
Yeah.
Look, we don't have 90 years in the kind of world that we live in right now,
yeah.
So we've really got to get going. But what I'm arguing for here is not just always looking at the United States and pointing the finger of responsibility and then sitting around doing nothing.
Yeah.
But actually, that's not what the Irish government is doing, by the way. I mean, I'm very clear that, you know, the Irish government is trying to do something. But it's an opportunity for everyone to stand up and say, OK, this is just too much. I mean, I remember, you know, as a much younger person watching what was happening, you know, here in Ireland. I mean, we all lived through some version of the Troubles. My sister was caught in the bombing in, basically in London tower, you know, kind of the whole... She was in the, you know, metro at the time. It wasn't like she was injured or anything. But it was just the whole, you know, and underground. Everybody had some experience. And think about what happened in Armagh. There were often events that really tipped people saying, OK, enough's enough. And I think we're well and truly there now. And if it's enough is enough, what are we all going to do, right? So give support to a process. And you don't get support by framing things in absolutist terms. You don't find a solution for basically pitting one against the other and saying it's either or. You find a solution by, you know, kind of acknowledging the complexity, acknowledging the difficulty, but digging deep into your humanity. And I think what Ireland has to offer there with the Northern Ireland peace process is, you know, at least a sort of starting point, the kind of way we should think about something.
Okay. Well, I think I can certainly say that if, and I would hope that my audience would share that, if you are working anywhere near or on the project of peace in the Middle East, then we can all have some hope. But for
it's
now,
not my thing, sadly.
It's,
but
been,
yeah.
It's been an absolute.
Thank you so much to Dr. Fiona Hill for joining Tony Connolly in Dingle. On next week's episode, we'll be discussing the future of the Irish healthcare system. To make sure you don't miss that or any of our future episodes, subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts. This has been a South Wind Blows production, and I'm Christopher Kissan. Thank you for joining us. I look forward to your company next time on Ireland's Edge.